From the boardroom to the locker room, sport captures the imagination like little else. In this podcast, we talk to the men and women who make the big decisions and those who make the big plays to find out where sport is and, importantly, where it's going. But we do so through the only eyes that matter, those of the fan. Welcome everybody to another edition of Are You Not Entertained? I'm refraining from calling it Are You Not Quarantined anymore because I think it's affecting my mood. Joining me, as always, the incomparable Roger Mitchell from In By The Lake. Roger, I presume you are still in situ?
Yes, we've got another week before they let us loose a little bit to wander the earth again. But this is getting quite... Actually, I nearly never made the podcast. I was stuck looking at The Last Dance, and time passed. It's orgasmic.
Hang on a second. Before we get into that, let's bring our third wheel in here, because we have this week the great and good Mr. Giles Morgan joining us for The Groundsman. Giles, are you there?
I am. Hello, gentlemen. How lovely to hear from you both.
Hi, Giles.
Hi.
Yes, good man. You two are lockdown is kind of a little loose, isn't it? You guys are at least allowed out of the house if you choose to.
Well, I'm delighted. I refuse to be a mammal as such. I do not wear lycra, but I have been cycling in my hour around London, and today I think I broke my own record, which is about 8 miles an hour, which is not very fast, but it was good for me. So I'm feeling quite chuffed.
What are the streets like? What are the streets like, Charles? Are they... Because my mates in England tell me it's just pretty busy over there.
It's getting busier now. It was that the first couple of weeks was extraordinary. I've lived in London all my life, and it was like a ghost town. And I cycled around Hyde Park Corner a couple of weeks ago, and I had it to myself, which wouldn't normally happen, obviously. And now it's getting busy. It's sort of like Boxing Day today. It has been like Christmas Day. It's sort of like Boxing Day now.
Interesting. Well, Rog, let's get back to The Last Dance, because I'm having to talk about that all day long.
Yeah. Well, you know, episode 3, the Dennis Rodman episode, and you know, it's compelling, absolutely compelling. Now, you know, I could talk about the stylistic way they do it, but built around him, obviously, then Scottie Pippen, and now Dennis Rodman. I'm on episode 3 today. But it's more than that, you know, like, and maybe this is just me, but I don't think so. You know, the way these guys are speaking, you know, all of them, it's not just Jordan. It's like, you know, that kind of like will to win, the determination, that whole American, you know, you're a winner or you're a loser. I just find it's enthralling. It's like energizing, you know, the Jordan rules of the Pistons. I mean, geez, it's magnificent, Grant.
Well, let me ask you this, because for me, I mean, I've followed this. I was following all that stuff you were watching last night. I was following it at the time. So this, you know, none of this is new to me. I knew about the Jordan rules. And if you're interested in that, Rose, there's a great book called The Jordan Rules by Sam Smith, who's one of the guys who's interviewed in the series. He was the Chicago Tribune writer. And he wrote a book called The Jordan Rules, which you'll really, really like if you're fascinated by that. So dig that out. But I followed his career. I followed that Bulls team. I was a huge NBA fan at the time, still am. So none of this is new to me, but seeing them talk about it now, with the benefit of hindsight and time to reflect, that I find fascinating. And how they look back on each other, their own parts in it, is enthralling to me, because I did watch it unfold in real time very, very closely.
The thing that strikes me, then I'll like to hear Giles as well, because he's a team sports guy. The thing that strikes me is that I've never been a basketball guy like you. And when I did get caught up in basketball, it was around the wonderful marketing of David Stern and the NBA. And it was all very glossy, and there was the imagery and, you know, Air Jordan and all that. And what this has done for me is take me into a dressing room where these guys are animals. You know, they're competitive animals, and you can, the way they talk about, you know, I'm going to win this. I just, as I say, for my kind of like personality, it's just wonderful.
Yeah, and I haven't seen it, so I'm literally, there's a queue of sports documentaries and films, and for various reasons, which are too boring to relate, I'm not watching any of them at the moment. And my only great fear is that lockdown's going to finish, and I'm going to have about 35 films still to watch, because everybody is talking about all of the things you talked about and the tests, et cetera, et cetera. So really exciting
I'm biased. I'd put The Last Dance off at the top because I think it's exceptional content. It's about perhaps the greatest athlete of my lifetime. But, you know, Roger, your point about the winning, you know, Jordan was the ultimate winner.
See, I didn't know that
competitor.
Before. I just thought he was great.
Oh, yeah. I mean, but this is why that is the central theme of this documentary is because everyone around him, if you didn't buy into that ethos, you were gone. I mean, he wouldn't tolerate anyone that didn't want to win. But whether it was playing cards on the team bus or whether it was practice or whether it was the NBA finals, he just refused to lose. I mean, it's extraordinary. It's an amazing mindset.
Well, it's something I find very, very interesting. Of all of the sportsmen and women that I've worked with in my former life, which obviously forms part of the captain's table, is that you have these sports people, and what separates them, other than, you know, there's great physicality, but it seems to be the mindset that distinguishes great sports people from sports people and then from amateurs. And then every now and then, and Jordan is one, they say Ian Botham would be another, where they've just got this insane will to win, which is entirely addictive, entirely when you hear competitive sports people talking about, in my case, about Botham, they say he was on another level. And I think Jordan had that, and it became part of the culture, and what a winning culture it was.
You know, I saw that when Rodman talks about when he let him down. And he knew he let him down, and he turns up at his hotel room door and knocks at the door and says, Mike, have you got another cigar for me? And that was the furthest he could get to saying, I'm sorry, I messed up. That was his way of doing it. I just think every scene, you know, and I'm talking from sport content now, it's done so beautifully, the way that they edit it all in and the comments. In fact, as I say, I nearly missed the recording time because the time flew in.
Well, you know, you can watch it on Netflix. I think if you're in Europe, they release it on Netflix the following morning.
Yeah, it's Netflix. So I'm watching it on Netflix.
Okay, yeah, fine. All right, well, look, enough of The Last Dance. We've got another. I've watched the first three. I woke up at like 4:30 this morning. It's like a kid on Christmas morning to watch that first one, Rog. And I've got one more to watch. I'm saving it for later on today when I start climbing the walls. But let's broaden out the scope of discussion, and let's talk a little bit about sport as we want to do in this particular show, The Groundsman. Obviously, we've spoken a lot about the fact that, like everything, sport is going to have to change. It is changing in during this lockdown period. But let's talk a little bit about what we've seen so far and what that might morph into in the future. Roger, I know that you've done a couple of remote conferences, which kind of seems to be the way forward. How have those been?
Well, technically very good. In terms of an idea, very good. What I would comment on, and I'm just being very honest here, is first of all, there's a lot of young people at the various broadcasters and social platforms and all the ancillary businesses. And I know this is something that's going to make you smile, Grant. I can see in their eyes, they've never been here before. They've never seen a downturn. And they're a little bit lost because the playbook that they've grown up with, you know, you do this, you grow that leads to this, that's not there anymore. I think a lot of them are still thinking that, well, we're in this moment, what you would call in your world, Grant, we're in a V-shaped recession. So let's talk about, you know, the second leg of the V and getting back to normal. I don't see an awful lot of thinking, and I know Giles has got strong views on this, a lot of thinking about things will never, ever be the same again, which is what I think. you know, and I listen to a lot of people, read a lot of stuff. A lot of it's really good stuff. But I don't think they're seeing two or three dominoes down the line. Here's what I think after being locked up and reading it all. Here's my top line, which is this. Whichever way you cut it, the sports industry has lost a huge amount of value, a huge amount of revenue. Now, I seem to see a lot of people talking about who should pay for that. Should it be players? Should it be club owners? Should it be the government? Bottom line is, somebody's got to pay for it. And rather than arguing about the various people and players taking cuts, and it's going to be the moment for big finance to come into sport, I think. And when they do that, watch out, because the rules will change. You know, you're starting to hear talks about merging of rights holders coming from people even like Federer. Then at the other side, you see things like Australian rugby, where they kick out that chief executive woman, who I thought was doing okay, but, you know, because she's not part of the old boys' network. So what I'm saying is, big money's going to come in to fill that gap, and the rules will be rewritten on the back of that.
And I would let me ask you this. Yep. Go ahead, Josh.
Well, no, and I would say that what's interesting about that statement, which Roger says, which I agree with, because there aren't going to be bailouts, there aren't going to be handouts. It's going to have to come from finance in order to re-energise the sporting sector. And that means that all of the things that Roger and I have been banging our head against the wall about was the landscape changed about 10 years ago and everybody ignored it. The Blazers kept on munching away on their pork pie and red wine, hoping that everything would stay the same. And effectively, the meteor has hit the earth. That's what's happened. And anybody who doesn't adapt dies. And the adaptation comes not from being so clever with new ways to engage. It's understanding the new rules that big finance requires different rules. And therefore, if you don't play with the rules, the nod, the wink, the handshake, the old boy network, whatever it was that got you to where it was, all goes out the window. It becomes meritocratic. It actually becomes very much more like pure sport, which is survival of the fittest, survival of the best. But you have to play with new rules. And that's what the sports industry is facing. And I'm refuse to go on a lot of these webinars and conferences, not because of the age thing, because it's just depressing, but more because there's too many people talking bollocks.
the thing that when I look at this, and I come at this, as everybody listening knows, I come at this little thing as the fan in our little triumvirate, not with any experience in sports administration or the sponsorship side of things. But I look at it through my lens of the world of business and finance. And what I suspect will happen is that when the lockdown is lifted, people have a very hard time in understanding, dealing with and coping with change. We as human beings, we don't do it well, right? When things change, we don't seamlessly move into that new paradigm. We fight against it because it's unfamiliar to us. And I suspect what will happen is the sports industry will do exactly what you two think they shouldn't and exactly what you two think they won't, in that they will go back to what they know and they will try and engage the fans with what worked before. Oh yeah, well, you know, we'll have a lot of spam, we'll have these old players will come out and they will assume that, back to your V bottom theory, Rog, they will assume that this is, we've gone down, we'll get back up, we'll get back to where we were before. I agree with both of you that the whole landscape of sport is going to change. But I strongly suspect that the people in sport are not thinking that way yet. I don't think they've gone straight to that. We are going to have to reinvent everything. We are going to have to change how we do things. We're going to have to play by new rules. I think they're thinking, right, you know, how long is it until we can do our, you know, halftime promotion again and get the fans back in by offering a, you know, two seats for the price of one or whatever it is.
But I think one of the problems, you're right, and it's interesting, there's so many people who are not thinking clearly. I'll give you an example in my old world of sponsorship, right? So there's lots of silence going on. The sponsors who've paid hundreds of millions of dollars to sponsor XYZ have all gone silent. And yet the fans are still there being fans, and they're still waiting to be engaged and loved, because sponsors don't really have any business with the sport. They have business with the fan. But where are they? The sponsors aren't thinking. They're just sitting there mutely, hoping this will all go away and hoping their investment is protected. If I was a sponsor of a major football club right now, I would be talking every day to that fan base, every day, trying to provide them with content, trying to provide them with hope, trying to provide them with a connection, because we're all fans, listeners to talking about sports documentaries. We're all there. We're primed. We're ready. We're bored. We want sport to be magic. But no, the big sponsors sit there mute. They sit there on their large tendrils, no one making a decision. That's just an example that I'm seeing all the time. And it's, in a sense, The destruction that is going to happen financially and economically is going to be awful, and jobs are going to be lost, and no one wishes that upon anyone. But the brave new world will be a brave new world, of which the sports industry at some point needed to get its head round, and now it's going to happen, and it's going to take 5 years. And yes, there will be, you know, it'll take a long time for fans to come back because of regulation, and that's quite right. But even then, things will look differently. The rise of esports, that's going to change. And people sitting there curmudgeonly saying, well, you know, there's nothing like the live occasion. No, there is nothing like the live occasion right now, because there aren't any fucking live occasions. So my point is that now is the time. It's a very exciting time, as Roger says, not about the V-shaped curve bounce back, but actually thinking. And people who think will win.
Well,
but right, Charles, I think you answered your own question in some way there at the beginning when you talked about how, you know, we're all here, we're all watching documentaries, we're here, we're waiting to be engaged. And I think it's not that they aren't thinking, it's that they are making that exact assumption that you said there, that is that we're all waiting, and we'll be there when sport comes back, and we'll be waiting, and we'll be ready to re-engage. We don't need to engage people now, because they are sitting there just desperate for sport to start again. And as soon as it does, we get back to normal. I think that's a catastrophic error.
But sorry, but just to take the sponsorship things, if you're a beer sponsor or a whatever it may be, you're not actually, you're not in football. You're selling beer. So sell more beer through it. So my point being is you've got a brilliant time to engage. And not all sponsors are engaging. They're sitting there in this sort of corporate world waiting for the TV figures, and the TV figures aren't going to be any because there is no TV data. So everyone's going to panic. And then you'll see sponsors saying, well, there's no TV data, there is no value. When there are hundreds of millions of fans sitting on their backsides waiting to love brands that love the things they love. And I'm, as you can tell, frustrated and curiously excited about the future, because what I look forward to is working with really good people who are thinking laterally and thinking about the future, but not in the, oh, well, it'll all be the same in a few years' time, and we'll get back to how it was, because it won't be.
Well, I'm ultimately at the very core still just a humble accountant. And I always love that phrase, just follow the money. So I agree with everything you're saying, but I think the first macro point is this one. There is a huge hole in the cash flow, and I can't see anybody really thinking about how to solve it. They're all talking about who should be doing this and how quickly can we get back so we can protect our broadcast contracts and everything like that. No coincidence, I don't think, that Gary Hoffman's now been announced as the chairman of the Premier League. He's a big finance guy. The bottom line, I think, is this. Now, the big finance has been wanting to get into sport. Sport is like their money. We started with Formula One. We saw it with rugby and CVC. Let's just be honest now. Let's say, look, we both need each other. We both want to hang out together. Let's do smart deals together so that we're not rushing back, which could be a bad mistake and an unhealthy mistake. Let's take your money, buy ourselves, and I think Chris Cairn said this the last episode, so I'm probably just plagiarizing him. Take our time, work out what the best model is, and go forward from there. But that's not happening. You know, it's still, you know, players should be taking this cut, or we should be getting back behind closed doors as quickly as possible. I mean, really, that's not the same product. You know, they think they're going to finish the Premiership at St George's Park in empty fields. that's not going to satisfy the broadcasters, really. So all these solutions are, let's call it, suboptimal. Let's get into discussions with serious finance people, big money, and say, how do we want to do this going forward? And take the positive, which is we're no longer going to run sports like a fucking bowling club. We're going to do it like any other business. That's what happened to the music business. They, in the end of the 90s, thought that they could ride out the Napster moment and it would all come back. And at the end of the day, big money told them how their industry would be structured going forward. That's what's going to happen to sport. I'm always a believer, get ahead of the curve, engage these people before you have to engage them. Engage them when you've still got a little bit of leverage and have a decent discussion.
But I think the way that these guys are thinking about it, Rog, is precisely the kind of the central theme of this podcast. They're not thinking about the fans. They're thinking, we want to get our product back, right? We want to get the Premiership finished. We want to get the Ryder Cup played. We, you know, behind closed doors or whatever, we just want to get the event played. Because forget the fans, no matter what we do, it'll be fine. They'll watch it, or they'll watch it on TV. They're not thinking about the fans, right? They're not thinking about the ground up. What are the people that give sport its heart and soul? What are those people want? And I think that is exactly the problem, and it kind of ties into what Giles said, but without looking at it that way around and thinking, okay, what are the people that pay the tickets and have this game in their hearts? What do they want?
Grant, that is exactly the point. Is the whole value of sport is the fan, and therefore this is the moment where start thinking about the fan, whether that be collecting the data of the fan that investors and sponsors would want, whether that be working out what to do with the fan based on their real habits, not the assumed habit. One of the things I was taught a long time ago is that assumption is the mother of all fuck-ups. And it's a great expression because it really resonates in sport, is that sport for years has just been assuming and carrying on doing the same old things because it's sort of always worked. And I don't mean this in a revolutionary, there couldn't be a more public school Che Guevara than me anyway. So I just...
You don't say.
But I just feel so strongly is that now is the time. Now is the time to take that deep breath, as Chris was saying on the podcast, and really think this through. We've got, you know, people have been shitting themselves about esports for years or since they got invented. Well, how about the time to combine esports into the mainstream and not seeing them as some sort of juvenile parvenu, but see them as a part of the future, part of the solution? Learn from esports, learn together, learn that it is all about the fan, about participation, about skills, and bring it all together. Let the IOC not do absurd voting from crusties with blazers about new sports that may or may not come in. But how about introduce sports that really will work for the 21st century? It's that kind of stuff that for me is if the revolution doesn't happen, or if evolution doesn't happen in the way that we're saying, then revolution will, and that will be where the newcomers come in. And so if I was a historian of sport, which I guess we all are to an extent because we all love it, but if I was Zed Smith, who is not just an England cricket selector but writes the history of sport, this is the greatest chapter in the history of sport that we are living right through right now.
Let me ask you both, as a fan, I'm talking to two people who have been immersed in the business side of sport for so long. What should they do? How should they be thinking? What changes should they make from administration level and from an engagement level, Giles?
Well, of course, there are a lot of people who are thinking, and it's probably a disservice to say no one's doing anything. Of course, that's not true. But I think the things that, I mean, Roger will come on here. The first thing that I would be doing is that because the technology exists, I would be collating all the information about the people who make the money, which is the individual fan. And that means data. And data is a very oft-used word, which sounds scary. But if you replace data for individual fan and information of them, it's not very scary. Understanding the fan, understanding geography, socioeconomic, understanding spend, trend, all the rest of it, which is what big business would do in any business, is look at habit, and which most industries have been doing for the last 5, 10, 15 years. Sport's been woeful at it, and sport needs to, because that in a sense, defines everything. It defines your media partnerships. It defines your sponsorship partnerships. It defines the people who will do business with you as investors. And it will create a pipeline for new fan base. Sport without fans there is no product. And yet they are probably the least well-served of the last 15, 20 years, in my view. So that's where I would be starting if I were a rights holder now. I would spend all my money on researching data. Not all of it, that's ridiculous, but a lot of it.
I would take a slightly different perspective on this. I see two different things here. One is what I mentioned before, the financial hole caused by this. And I've talked about how I think that needs to be patched over. That is an existential problem that anybody that runs a business needs to solve. And that's a money issue. And I talked about how I think you solve that. The second issue was around before the virus, and we've discussed it for 2 years. It's the fact that there isn't a definition of a fan anymore. The 55-year-old male white guy that goes to watch Millwall is not the same as the Chelsea fan that sits in Kuala Lumpur. The fan who goes to their local ground at Peterborough isn't the same as the person that watches on their sofa and enjoys that and has no real aspiration to go to the ground. The fact that the age demographics of most sports are horrendously middle-aged and male and white. Those problems haven't been created by the virus. The virus is just, as I've said before, Franz Ferdinand. So what do you do? You need to find meaning, like in anything. You need to find out what your meaning is as an organization. And the problem with sport, Grant, is that the governing bodies are way too fragmented. You know, I could be sitting as head of a league as I was, and my role, to answer your question, what do? Is I do what my professional background tells me what to do. I look after the people who are paying me, in that case, the member clubs. I do what is in their interests, not what's in the interest of their customers. That's their problem. I do what is in the interest of 12 club owners. If I'm at the FA, I have got a duty to foster and grow the game at all levels. Completely different mandate. You multiply that in tennis, in golf, and you understand why sport is fucking bouncing off the walls, because they haven't understood what their actual objective is anymore. And until they do, they'll just keep pointing the fingers and saying, this is for you to solve.
And I think it's a very fair statement, that because sport has grown, you know, the governance and the foundation stones of sport were not invented overnight one day. They've evolved over time, and therefore you have different governing bodies and different people with different blazers and different crests and different motifs and different white shirts, and everybody is so protective of their own patch that they forget, exactly to Roger's point, they forget what they're there to do is to serve the fan, to serve the passionate supporter of whatever that sport is. And as a result, you see fragmentation. And I thought it was very interesting, Federer talking about a blending of the federations together, of the men and women coming together, which has caused horror, of course, in some corridors, because they're looking to protect themselves rather than the good of the game. And it's exactly right. I remember in my HSBC days, sort of learning to surf the politics of the golf world. And it was quite easy for me to surf, even though I haven't got the body for it, because I had the checkbook. So everybody agreed largely with the checkbook. So it was quite an easy run. But you to get something done, you'd have to go to six sort of organizations and governing bodies, have a very pompous supper, and hope everybody agreed. Nonsense. For the good of the game, growing it in China, let's not have a debate about it. Let's just see what needs to be done. It's that kind of thing. And I use just an example, but it is so true. There is so much fat in the sports industry of sort of weird structure that needs to be. It's a pruning that needs to happen. I'm just looking at my garden now and it's an absolute mess. Pruning shears are required.
Well, if it's anything like my hair, then good luck with that. what I hear listening to the two of you again, with my fan hat on, is that these sporting bodies have an incredible opportunity here.
Yep.
In the sense of they've got an entire globe of sports fans, and we know what that means if you're a sports fan. It's you crave it. Who've been starved of what they crave for months, right? So there's a huge opportunity. The challenge is that when people get presented with the chance to engage with sport again, one, they're going to be reluctant to do it in large groups, and two, they're going to be much more conscious of the money they're spending on sport, which, even though it's a passion, the people who have been struggling to put food on the table or pay a mortgage are going to realize that, well, you know what, my weekly trip to Arsenal is going to have to go to a bi-weekly trip because this economic event is going to change people's behavior. So how do the sporting bodies marry those? How do you take this extraordinary opportunity and deal with and circumvent the extraordinary challenge that comes with it?
Grant, sorry, I keep having to come back to this. This is where our American cousins have a great advantage. Sport in America was born as a business and as such has pretty decent governance and pretty clear lines of responsibility. And, you know, the world has got quite a lot of smart men and women around. And if you've got clear governance and clear lines of power and responsibility, you can work it out. That's my experience in business and life. You can work it out. The problem in sport is that, yeah, you've got the same smart men and women around. You cannot go through the maze because you just have conflicts of interest, difference of opinions, all of that stuff. So I can't get past the fact that this is the moment when sport needs money, somebody's got money, that person, the Pied Piper, can say to sport, I'm not going to put up with your bullshit anymore. This is how governance is going to be, and here are the people that I'm going to put in charge of it. I can't get beyond that, Grant, because if you don't get that right, your little tactics of execution and how you get everybody back there and how you deal with their less purchasing power, that's two or three derivatives down from the real problem, I think, mate.
Charles, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there's a combination that needs to happen, which is cool heads. It needs to have the right people coming together to say, okay, we've got a zero base and start now. What is best for our sport? Because if we don't get this right, it's not about getting the limo or getting the business class flights to go and watch the next tournament. It's the sport's future. And therefore, if you take it on that, where, again, I don't want to be someone, I don't think anybody alive has been through anything as impactful as the virus. Wars are very different, of course, but just in terms of the impact. And I think a lot of people, particularly a lot of these young people on the web conferences, don't have the faintest idea of what is actually about to happen to the sports world. And therefore, it is about survival, and therefore, it is about doing the right thing. And the way to survive is by putting the fan first, by thinking through the governance, getting that, make that efficient, make decision making efficient, get the right people to do it, and start from there. Because otherwise, you're gonna make the same decisions from the same imbeciles who've been making, in many cases, for a long, long time.
Grant, can I ask you something? Because you know. You say you're just a fan on here. That's not true. You're actually a content professional and commentator at quite a high level. I want you to take me through how you see, first of all, the bellwether of sport, which is Endeavor IMG, pulling their IPO and then having their debt downgraded. At the same time that you're seeing... you've written a lot about Netflix and how you see that all panning out and theatres and cinemas and everything like that. Give us your view as a fan with that kind of knowledge and tell us what you would do if you were catapulted in to be head of sport czar for the British government.
Well, I know, Roger, I mean, that's such a big issue, and my response to it is probably why that
was
why that would never happen. But look, it's interesting, right? Because we've spoken a lot about big business and its impact on the sport world and the fact that pre the virus, that impact was only going to get bigger. And now here we are talking about post the virus, it's only going to get bigger, except I think it's two completely different ways, right? The way that sport was going to be overtaken or subsumed by big business prior to COVID was in the same way that big business subsumes everything, which is you come in, you buy an asset, you gear the living bejesus out of it, you lever it up, right? You go into enormous amounts of debt to do what you're going to do, and then you know you strip what you can out of it, like these private equity firms do, and you create a commodity, right? You apply your playbook to it, and you create a commodity. And you know, I've had my doubts that this would work, that this model would work, because sport is in some ways a commodity. But when if you kind of get down to the grassroots of it, which is what I've heard you both say, this is about the fan. Sport is only there because of the fan. Then when you get down to it, it isn't just a business. It isn't just a model. This is heart and soul, and that doesn't sit well in the normal sense of things with big business. Now, post-COVID, it's going to be very different, because what's going to happen is the clubs will be susceptible to big business in terms of they're going to need money, right?
Yep.
They're going to need access to capital. They're going to need to plug those holes. And that creates an extraordinary opportunity for the likes of the private equity firms to come in and scoop up assets, which they will call them, not clubs, but let's go and scoop up some trophy assets at fire sale prices. And we'll run our trick again. We'll try and gear things up, and we will you know, run all the plays that we've been running for years. Now, I suspect that in this new post-COVID world, and as you say, Roger, I've written a lot about this, I do believe that this is one of those events, as Giles alluded to earlier in this podcast, that is going to change our way of life in dramatic ways. And I don't think we quite understand all the ways that's going to happen. But I think what is going to happen, if you look back to the Great Depression and what happened after the Great Depression, the one thing that was clear right around the world was that nobody wanted debt anymore. People saw what over-leverage did to the world during the Great Depression. We had this deflationary event, and it killed the world. And we had a generation, two generations of people that just simply refused to borrow money. I don't think that's going to change initially in terms of what the private equity firms will likely do. They will come in and they will borrow to acquire the assets, and then they will gear up to try and make money out of them, make them work for them. But on the other side of the balance sheet is the fan, and their balance sheets are impaired, and they are not going to have access to the kind of cheap money the private equity has. And so I don't think they're going to play the game the same way, Rog. I don't think people are going to want to go to 25 games a year, paying for a family of four $100 or £100 for the privilege. I think that is all going to change. So I think the same playbook is going to be tried. I think a lot of clubs are going to end up in the wrong hands. And we're going to have to go through a period where the people that come in to quote unquote save sport completely screw it up, because what they want to do and what the fans want are at odds. They want to increase prices and make money and make profits. And the fans are going to say, I can't afford the existing prices. I need you to cut prices. I need you to strip out all the stuff that I've been paying for, but I can't afford to pay for anymore. And I just want to go and sit in a seat and watch my team win or lose with my son, have a cup of Bovril at halftime, hashtag other drinks are available, although not many made out of meat, it has to be said. And I want to go back. I want to go back to sport. I want it stripped down. I want all the faff taken out of it. And I want to pay for that stripped down product. And that, I think, is going to be the huge problem that faces the people
but
who
is
come
it,
in.
But, and, is it, but is it a good, you're right on all of that. Of course you're right on that. And one could argue that the Endeavour IPO miss and the debt downgrade is exactly that, because that is quite a levered company, Endeavour.
Yeah, of course it is.
Right, so let's assume that that's just as a bellwether showing what's going to happen. But let's come back a wee bit micro now. You know, like, remember Sir Alan Sugar, that famous phrase of Sir Alan Sugar.
Oi, Lord Sugar. God, you'd be out on The Apprentice in week one.
Sorry, I'm not in the UK anymore. Lord Sugar. I worked for him, by the way. I was just Alan at the time.
Did you really?
Yeah, I did work for him. Yeah, at Amstrad in Italy. But anyway, the point is, he said prune juice effect, which has been the story of sport of all these years. We've had 30-year bull market in rights, which the benefits of which have gone directly to the players and the agents. And conversely, when that reverses, they're the ones that will take the hit. So is it such a problem? You know, like, are we that bothered that it's no longer 400 grand a week and it comes back down to 40 again? And a footballer, a rugby player, is a lot more close to the fan that watches them the way it used to be in the 60s and 70s.
No, we're not bothered. That's not the point. The point is not whether we're bothered about that. That would be wonderful for sport. It would be appalling for business. And what my concern is, we're going to have this period before we get to that, Rog, where business does everything it can to make sure that that new world you just described is the last thing that happens, because there's no margin
in it. I don't agree with that, Grant. I think what big business comes in and says, listen, the sport industry, running a football club or a rugby club, is pretty easy. The metric is this one, wages to turnover. 75's too high, 60's nice, 50, you've got a nice business. Below that, you're raking it in. The Americans have understood that. They've got salary caps forever. We've started getting there a little bit. You get this big finance coming in and they say they're enlightened and they give the idea that you've given that people won't have the same money. So the top line revenues from merchandising, from match day, even from subscriptions is going to come down. They factor that in and then they say, here's the deal, sport. I will allow you maximum to spend 50% of my revenues, because I now own you, on talent, on players. Now, sort it out, it's a default in my mind. That's my covenant. What do you think of that, Grant?
Okay, so let's talk about the single biggest revenue earner for all these clubs, which is what, Rog?
TV.
Merchandise, right?
No.
Merchandise.
No.
At the club level.
No.
At the club level. Listen, I get the TV contracts. I get the TV contracts, but Real Madrid are trying
peanuts,
to sell as many
peanuts,
Gareth Bale shirts.
Peanuts, mate.
Huh?
It's peanuts. I know it's,
you think?
I know it's peanuts. It's TV, it's match day. And then you've got sponsorship, you've got licensing, you've got merchandise, small number. I wouldn't know exactly the percentage, but I'd be surprised if it was more than 15%.
I bow to your superior knowledge. To me, that seems insanely low, but I'm not going to argue on this stuff. Your knowledge is much greater than mine.
My point is that the
kid who wants his new Arsenal shirt every year, gone, right? You're just not going to make those sales. The guy that wants, when he goes to the game, to spend 100 quid on, you know, whatever it may be that's ancillary to the game, the experience of watching the game with his son, gone. There's a huge hit going to happen to the revenue that could be counted on. You know, you can't take your family to the movie theater, right? I mean, let's just go back to the movie theater without spending more on a bucket of popcorn and a Coke than you did on the tickets. What do you think is going to happen there? People are still going to want to go to movies, but they're not going to want to pay
the concessions. My point, Grant, sorry, now, I want to hear Giles what he says, but my point is this, your pressure release is the simple player cost. You know, so let's say you say everything you say is right. So I'm going to half the ticket prices to come along. I'm going to let kids in for free. I'm going to say to Nike and Adidas that you can't charge more than 30 quid for a replica kit. All of those things. So let's say I'm going to assume my revenues are half what they were before. That doesn't matter as long as the players bear the brunt of that.
I completely agree with the players bearing the brunt of it. Yes.
Well, so
completely.
That's it. You accurately project your revenues, your forecast revenues. You be as pessimistic as you're saying here, and you're probably right. And then you say, well, you've got 50% of that for the players. That's your budget. Where's the difficulty?
So you mean run sport like a business, Rog? No, I mean, I'm being facetious, but that's the point, right? The big thing here, and this goes way beyond sport, right? This goes way beyond sport. You are going to have to, as of the end of lockdown, you are going to have to run your business like a business. You are going to have to run it to make a profit. You are not going to be able to do what the private equity guys have done and what a lot of these guys have done, which is gear it up, load debt on the balance sheet, and you know, we'll strip everything out of it, and we'll figure out how to make money out of it later on. That's not going to work anymore. People are going to have to get real and run things like a business, and that will change everything. I mean, imagine those first conversations with the players' agents when the contracts are offering you. I mean, I would love to be a fly on the wall in those things, because you know what's going to happen. They are not going to get it. They're going to go, well, I'm just going to go elsewhere. And the answer is going to be, well, okay, off you go. And there'll probably be a few clubs that have deep pockets and think that they can ride this out. And, you know, we'll sign all these players. We won't give them what they were getting, but we'll give them more than what they could get elsewhere. And we'll bring them here. But the whole model is going to have to change, because if you go a couple of years without making a profit, you're done.
Yeah, and I mean, you've both been saying this. I mean, the biggest problem in most of the sports, the big sports, and the Americans do it so much better, is about wage cap, or whatever cap you want to call it. I think of the game of golf and tennis. People deny this, and the governing bodies deny this till they're blue in the face. But to get a big name golfer or tennis player to one of the non-majors, one of the non-slam events, of which they have colossal prize money, which is largely borne by the sponsor, I should say. The appearance fees for the top 15 players in the world is colossal. And I will never divulge the spend in my former life, but an awful lot of that money went into the pockets of individuals, with a nice little percentage going off to the agent, who did two-thirds of fuck all. So that doesn't work, because big sponsors are not going to have the budgets. They're going to want to know exactly how every dollar is going to be spent. And therefore, they want to know the value, and therefore, they need to know the fans. So all of this comes into a place of run it like a business. And that's why I'm not depressed that the sports world is going to be over, because sport, as we're all sort of chewing our fingernails, dying to get live sport back, there is a massive fan base of people who love live sport. It's just going to look different, because it's going to have to be pulled back, and everything is going to have to be thought through a lot more carefully, because you will not go to the big blue chips right now and say, right, we need 50 million off you. You might get that money, but you're gonna have to show the value, rather than the chief executive officer saying, well, it's quite fun going to Monaco, so let's sign the check. It's over.
Well, I think that's right. You know, I wrote the other day something about what I think will be the key axioms of running football going forward. And it went along the lines of player contracts in the main will probably last a season, will be very short term. They will be significantly based on success fee and what in business is called hitting your deliverables. So low fixed cost, high variable cost. I think there'll be an edict to make sure, as I said before, that you're not spending more than 50% of your revenue, whatever that is, depressed as it is, on player wages. I think, to your point, Giles, we are about to enter the golden age of sports data, both for the sponsorship side that you've talked about, but also on the football side, the work that can be done in machine learning about finding the real added value in what will be a buyer's market for players in terms of scouting, recruiting, even injuries. I think there's a huge upside there. And if you look at teams like Atalanta, remember them, still in the Champions League. Gaddafi in Spain, punching well above its weight. I've come right back to the start of what you said, Giles. Sport is about to enter an era of meritocracy. It's for too long had a dominance of what I call G&T man, you know, the relationship guy, the guy that can slap, you know, 20 guys in the room and they know each other and they're comfortable in each other's mediocrity. I think that's ending. I know you're laughing at that, but that's true.
No, I like it. I think that's the end of my career.
And I think you're going to have to run it like a business. Now, coming back to your point about leverage, Grant, and this is classic corporate finance theory, you know, Modigliani, if you want, you know, leveraging up is a good thing, but what is the optimum level of debt? You know, and a million PhD papers on that. The fact is that it's not fucking 90%. It's something between, you know what I mean?
But Rog, sadly, that's going to come as a surprise to a lot of people.
Right. But what I'm saying is, since I'm not a lot of people, I am going to take that 40 to 50% debt because it's got a lower cost of capital. The interest on that is going to be part of my P&L account. And I'm still going to budget to make a profit because my release variable is player wages. And since it's a buyer market, I think I'm going to do just fine. That's my answer.
So, but how do we make the what does the transition look like from here to there? What does the next transfer window look like, Rog, when this reality, and I agree with you, I think you're absolutely right. Of course, the player wages are the release valve, right? You're paying guys 400 grand a week. I mean, we've known for a long time it's ridiculous. We've said on this show for 2 years it's unsustainable. We were talking about the long term, and now suddenly that's a problem they're going to have to confront in the very short term. But what does that look like, do you think? How do we get from here to there?
Market forces, attrition, football. I'm just talking about football, but it's the same for rugby and everything like that. These are sports guys, and coming right to the start of our podcast, they know what winning and losing is all about. So I think you can have a very clear understanding with them. You can say, look, you know, you've got 2 years left. At this current wage, you have got no fucking chance to be renewed by me, regardless of what you do in the next 2 seasons. I can't afford you. So we can have that discussion now and give you a new 5-year contract on this level, or we will be in a marriage of convenience for 2 years where we'll both have a PR war to win over the fans and none of us will win. So do you want to have a sensible conversation or not? That should be happening now, Grant.
Yeah, I don't disagree. But I think if you think about the vested interests here, Rog, and obviously you and I both know you always have to think about the vested interests here. The players don't want to take a salary cut, obviously, right? And they are, for the most part, and I don't want to create stereotypical problems here, but they are generally young, inexperienced men who rely on their agents to do all this stuff for them. I mean, you know, we saw in the Sunderland documentary, the season two, right, the centre forward guy, who was a lovely kid, who was obviously being played by his agent, totally. We saw what happened there, right? And the agents are absolutely not incentivized to do the right thing for the club, period. So I absolutely agree. We're going to get to where you think we're going to go, but I think if you think that is one conversation, saying, "Listen, guys, here's where we are. We all need to be sensible about this. Yada yada yada. Here's what you got to do. You got to take a massive wage cut, or we're going to sign you for much less for longer." The agents are going to screw all that up because they are going to kick and scream and fight because there's nothing for them to lose, right? They're not public-facing people. They don't have a profile. They're suits behind the scenes, apart from two or three of the super agents who can afford to be dicks about this because they're trying to protect their own livelihood exist anymore.
So true, Grant. So you deal with the problem, you cross that bridge when it comes to it. You know, so then maybe you think, what's my average contract left on players? Let's call it 2.5 years. For 2.5 years, I'll be bleeding cash. You know, so where's that PE company again? And that's where your 40, 50% debt comes in. You cover this 2-year period of transition. And then you make sure that going forward, you've got a business that's got a marginality of 10, 15, 20%.
Well, I hope you're right. I mean, I really
there's
do.
No option, really Grant. There's right. No option. There's
no,
I mean,
like, No, I agree. It's, as I say, it's for me, it's the speed of the phase shift that is problematic, because the longer it takes for that realization to dawn on people, the more upheaval there's going to be, the more pain there's going to be, the more disenchantment there's going to be. Because, yes, what you say is true, right? Ultimately, we're entering a world where the numbers are going to need to add up somehow.
Yeah.
But right now, we are in a world where they've never, ever added up less than they do now. And so the transition from one to the other is one which just about everybody is going to fight against, because it's in nobody's best interest except the fan, right, to find this new reality. The fan is the only person to whom this is beneficial, period. It doesn't help business. It doesn't help the players. It doesn't help the clubs. It doesn't help any of them except the fan, which is wonderful once we get there. But the clubs and the players and the agents, I'm sorry, but they are not in business to protect the fan first. They're just not. So it's going to be a tremendous amount of upheaval. It's going to be a very difficult path to transition and take the power away from the people who have it and give it back to the people who, frankly, should have it all along. But it goes against the interests of the former, and they have that power, so they're not going to give it up without a fight, Roger.
No, you're right.
Let the games begin.
Yes.
The gloves are off.
Yeah, that's a good way to finish. That's exactly where we are. And you know, from my own point of view, I always quite enjoy periods of quick change management and transition and turbulence, because it really is Warren Buffett and the tide coming out. And I embrace that, Grant, I must admit.
Well, plus, Rog, if I may quote one of your countrymen, freedom! Or was he Australian? He might have been Australian. I can't remember.
Well, he's sort of Australian/American as well.
Yeah.
Oh, well. Him.
All right, gents. Well, look, that is a perfect way to wrap it up. So why don't we do that? And thank everybody for listening to us rant and pontificate. And I would say that obviously the three of us have no idea what's going to happen. We're guessing. And anyone that tells you they know what's going to happen is talking nonsense to you. So don't listen to them, even if it's us, because we don't know. But at least we're the first to admit it. One thing is for certain, though, whatever happens next is going to be fascinating to watch. And I think incredibly important for the next sort of 10, 15, 20, maybe longer years as sport develops. So the one place I guarantee you'll find us talking about it is here on Online Entertain. So please share this podcast. Our thanks to you for joining us this week. And if you're new to the podcast, there's plenty more episodes you can download. And you'll be able to find those in the iTunes store. Are You Not Entertained? You can follow us on Twitter. At Entertained R, that's the word, A-R-E. You can follow me on Twitter at T-T-M-Y-G-H.
You can follow me, Giles Morgan, at GilesMorgan71. And I would say that for next week, we have former Ryder Cup captain Thomas Bjorn, who has the most frightening eyebrows in sport, joining me on the show.
And you can follow myself at RPM Como, as in the lake.
As in the lake. Gentlemen, as always, a pleasure and a thrill, and we'll do it again.
Fantastic.
What do you say?
Thank you. Thanks, Giles. Fantastic. Thanks, Grant.
Bye.
End recording.